All right, so this is the Brothers Wisp number whatever. I can't remember anymore. It's been so long since we've done it. We just lost Andrew Thrift, unfortunately, but he'll probably pop back in. So up on the top left, you got the indomitable Tom Smith up there from Ireland. He's very Irish. Every cliche, he eats Lucky Charms every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Then you've got in the middle there, you got Mike Hammett, crazy guy from up north around Chicago way. Right, aren't you? You're up there, right?
Yeah. I can see the Sears Tower from some of my network.
Oh, good deal. And then over on the right, you got J.J. Boyd, our boy out in North Carolina.
Hello.
Holding it down. Man, all of you guys together. It's almost too much sexy for one podcast.
Yeah.
And that's just counting Tom.
Well, what can I say? Actually, I slurred my words there and I haven't had any drink. I'm having tea, just so you know.
Oh, okay.
There's nothing in the tea, only tea and milk.
Tea and milk.
Honestly.
What part of Ireland are you? You're in Dublin, right?
Well, I'm living in Dublin. I'm working in Dublin, but I'm from a place called Tipperary, which is in the Midlands. Pretty nice. You should come and visit.
I would love to.
There. That's my plug for Tourism Ireland there. Just sorted there. Actually, I just wanted to ask Mike, does he feel privileged that Obama, you know, was his representative, you know, longer than any of the rest of the guys there? And are you his big fan? Is it true, the rumor?
I'm not sure it's a privilege. It is true, but not, it's really a privilege.
Well, apparently Obama's origins, like I used to pass Moneygall, the town in Ireland that his great-great-great-grandfather was, you know, from. So I actually used to pass it on the way to our farm because we actually live away from our farm. It was kind of one of those things. My dad had two jobs. He was a farmer and a teacher. So he decided that he didn't have to get up at 9 o'clock every morning to go to the farm. So he said he'd live near to the school and then drive every afternoon to the farm. So anyway, we used to pass Obama's heritage every day. So there you go.
For everybody who doesn't know, there's kind of an ongoing joke between Tom and Mike, a little bit of banter back and forth about Mike's, I guess, what, ultra-conservative leanings?
In some aspects, yeah.
But like, I think we agree on some points, in fairness. And JJ, you're more of a libertarian. Would I be correct in saying that?
Yeah, you would be correct in saying that.
I'd actually lean more towards that side. I'd kind of be right of Democrat, left of some of the... Definitely far left of Tea Party, but more centre. I think I'm kind of the middle.
I think I would have more in common with the Tea Party.
Well, maybe not the crazy part. The more like the fiscally conservative part, yeah?
Yeah, and the firearms part and the constitutions part.
Well, firearms, I have to say, I've been is understandable. We're going to have to edit this.
Well, this was a technology program.
Yeah, everybody knows we're all making this up.
Version and an international version or something, like, you know, and edit out the good parts. The audience, supposedly.
But on Obama's roots there, he loves coming to Asheville, North Carolina to eat our barbecue. So the rumor is that he's potentially going to retire here after his second term. So
in
maybe
North
I can
Carolina?
Sell him some internet. Yeah.
Well, you know what? I would be glad to have him move to North Carolina out of Illinois.
What about Clinton? If he could go for a third term, would you go vote for him?
Oh, Bill Clinton? No. Well, Hillary's about to run, so that's
Hillary.
As good as. Yeah.
No, but would you, let's say if there was a way he could come back like Mr. Putin did in Russia. right. If there was a way he could do a switcheroo.
So if he rode in shirtless on horseback, Putin style.
I thought that was a tiger.
Yeah. Oh no. He actually wrestled a tiger to the ground.
Oh.
Put the tiger on him. Then he walked around the Kremlin.
Didn't he go down in like a submarine or something and discover or rescue something not too long ago?
He found a precious antique at the bottom, a treasure, but it was actually put there by one of his entourage about 10 minutes before and said, "It's down there." With a laser pointer. Dick here.
Oh, that's like the worst Easter egg I've ever.
You're going to find an old bicycle. Not worth anything, you know? Or an old shoe, but no. So would you like? Did you like Bill Clinton? Did you think he was cool?
I was too young to know the difference. I think at that.
Was he cool for a Democrat? Let me ask that question.
Oh, because he. Well, I mean, he slept around. And he played the saxophone. I mean, what's? He's like a modern day Ron Burgundy, I guess.
The economy was pretty good, though. He was good on the economy, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
well, I guess you could say that.
It's a can of worms, though, because some people will argue that, you know, the preceding presidents had set him up for this, you know, and had everything in place, but who knows? I think things were pretty good.
Well, I have to say, I like being in the States. Kind of cool people, met a lot of people, and, you know, lots of different opinions, but it's pretty cool.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you're going to be back over here pretty soon anyway, right?
I am. I'm going to talk about something about router security.
On version 7.
What?
Oh, shots fired.
To my friends in Mikrotik, this is me. Trying to maintain composure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can talk political all you want and bash Tom there. Just don't mention in version 7 at this point.
Sorry. Code review. I'd say code review, manual code review, best practices. Have a quick look. Try and find the discontinuities, the divide by zeros, the infinite loops, the memory leaks. I've said too much.
Yeah, we'll call that one good. So the mom's coming up in Pittsburgh.
2 months.
Yes.
Yeah. What is that? The end of August, beginning of September.
It's the second week of September, I think.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. So I'm going to be there. Tom's obviously going to be there. JJ, you going?
Yes.
All right. How about you, Mike?
I was thinking about it, but I guess if everybody else is going,
I was
going
to say, like, you have anything better to do? You know, you're going to be there.
Well, then Justin would be on the way, so I can pick him up.
There you go. And so before we get going, really, I wanted to say one more thing, and that's congratulations to Tom on squeezing out another clone.
Very nice.
Yeah, well,
congratulations.
Cheers, thanks. Congratulations, I think, to my wife, Asha. It's a bit weird, actually. I keep calling her my girlfriend, and she's going, "Who's that?" And I'm like, "Oh, I meant you."
Yeah, wife. It takes time to adjust.
No, I named him Danny Henry. And I named him unilaterally, which meant early on in the pregnancy, which meant I had to spend the rest of the pregnancy begging, because I said to my dad, "Oh, I'm naming him after you." But I hadn't quite discussed it with the wife, so it took a while to kind of get the approval. But finally, while she was in labor, I was kind of holding the pillow. Come on, Danny!
You had that. It was if you want the epidural, then it's going to be Danny. Is that what it's kind of?
But yeah, she did actually ask for it, but the nurse kind of said, "You're about to go, so pretty useless now."
Oh, so they just gave it to you instead?
I actually asked, could I inhale the gas? They said, well, they were polite. They just said, "F off." But she didn't say it, her face said it.
Gotcha.
Well, story, Justin.
What's up?
So we're just talking about...
for this, I might have to go get the other one.
Yeah, we were just talking about Tom's new kiddo.
Thanks very much. He's pretty cool. Danny Henry. Watch this space.
That's cool. That's cool, man. All right, so, Justin, you going to the mom coming up here pretty soon? Maybe not. I guess he froze. He disconnected. So, anyway, what are we going to talk about on this one, other than the obvious things?
See, we were having some discussion about fiber to the home the other day.
Yeah, yeah. So GPON, all that good stuff, and I've done just a little bit of research on it. I haven't actually done any of it, I know you guys are a lot heavier into that, and I was just curious. You know, because you guys were shooting back and forth. Mike has his own opinion about doing point-to-point. He's not kind of a big proponent of the pawn idea. So I guess just kind of as a loose overview, GPON is going to be where you gigabit passive optical network, so you can run, 32 channels, I guess, reasonably, on a single strand, comes back to a special optic, and it does kind of its own little TDM time slices to all the clients, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good representation of it. And then on top of that, you have other flexibilities too, because the PON portion of the network only consumes, let's say, one channel. So you still have your CWDM channels and your DWDM channels that you could illuminate on that same fiber if you needed to leverage those technologies for capacity. Using ROADMs and or reconfigurable add drop multiplexers, which basically are just a fancy way of saying that I got a prism at every pop where I can inject and remove wavelengths as I see fit at every location.
Okay. And so Mike's more of a fan of the just kind of the point-to-point methodology, right? So you pull it all back to a single point, you just do Ethernet, right?
Yeah, to JJ's point there about the ROADMs and the whatnot, traditionally residential PONs have just been just the standard PON. You know, you start adding other stuff in, it does become more attractive, because one of the limits of the PON is the bandwidth. You know, when you put 32, 64 homes, they're all sharing that 2.5 gig, which we think, you know, we're sharing 100 meg APs, what's 2.5 gig, and we're never going to see that. But most of the WISPs that I've seen have been rolling their own fiber, have been doing just the point-to-point. Because the electronics are so much cheaper. Obviously all the big guys, the Verizons or what and whatnot, they're all doing PON to their hundreds of thousands of homes. But and obviously if you're leasing fiber, you know, PON is the way to go, because every customer you buy, you got to lease more fiber, and that just gets too expensive.
Right. Well, I mean, GPON obviously uses specialized hardware, right? So you've got a special
OLT.
Yeah, OLT. There you go. And then what, the ONT is the head end?
The ONU. Or I think the OLT, you got the optical line terminator, which is on the head end of the network. And then you got the ONUs, which are the optical networking units.
There you go. And those guys are generally proprietary. So the TDMA, you can't cross stream. So you can't go from one vendor's TDMA to some other vendor's, right? So whoever is supplying the head-end equipment also supplies the end-of-the-line equipment, right?
Yeah. And there's some Chinese stuff out there that is extremely affordable. The software would probably leave a lot to be desired. And we're, you know, I'm still exploring all this. I'm just in intensive research mode right now. But to me, the physical aspect of it for doing point-to-point fiber kind of gets cumbersome. Like, let's say you go into a housing development, and now this may just be true of my region, but our housing developments are very linear in nature because it's all up mountain roads and it's all, you know, curvy. It's not like a grid where you have, you know, like the suburbs and then you just have a huge grid of homes. All of our home developments are, you know, some curvy road that snakes up some, you know, hill or mountain. So they're all extremely linear in nature. So for around here, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense to pull, you know, let's just make it simple and say you had 144 houses and you pull 144 count up the middle of the road. And then so the first house, which may only be 100 yards, you cut into that fiber there. And then that leaves a tail that's however long the community is. So I'm just
fiber, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's, whereas, like, in our, in my area, it's all flat, you know, they'll take a, a new housing development takes a, say a square mile, field or whatever, and they just start plowing in roads, and then, there's various, obviously different, patterns to the developments, but but it's not just 144 all in a row,
right?
Gotcha.
I mean, there's a lot of challenges in there. So one is going to be, is it a brownfield? Is it a greenfield? Right, greenfield being mean, there's nothing there. So that, I mean, you could just pull next to everybody else's utilities, get your fiber in there really easy. I think probably 99.9% of what everybody's looking at is brownfield. It's something that's already existing. So you've got to worry about, boring under streets. You got to worry about crossing sidewalks, all of the just the painful aspects of it. You're going to have
the railroads. They're a nightmare.
We just
started researching that, and it's scary.
Every railroad project we've done where we had to bore under took at least 6 months minimum, usually 6 months to a year. So that's just, because you have to have everything spec'd, you have to adhere to all of their rules, and then once they finally agree to it, you have to pay a flagger something like $500 a day to stand there and watch you do your work. And it's so painful. And if you do anything wrong, you are in big trouble. But also, whenever you're talking about the different technologies, not only so if you go with a GPON solution, it's proprietary, you're locked into whatever vendor you end up choosing. You can't switch midstream. I guess you could and just try and shift over. But in those units, they sort of the provisioning is a lot different than we're accustomed to. You don't just grab the end user piece of gear like the CPE that we're accustomed to and configure it and then throw it out in the house. The system kind of auto provisions more like cable motor plant, I guess. So with the dedicated, hopefully, guys, you can't hear all that thunder out here, but. Hopefully, with the dedicated Ethernet solution. So Mike was talking about how some people are maybe throwing out like a MikroTik 2011. It's got the SFP cage. You're going to have to hand configure each one of those units. You can do, kind of some bulk provisioning. But you still have to touch each one of those units, whereas the other ones are more just kind of throw them out there. They provision in the system, and you configure from a unified interface. But then some of those manufacturers do... do Ethernet PON solutions, right? Where it's a one-to-one, and I'm guessing they still do the auto provision piece, right?
What are you talking about exactly?
Well, I've seen some vendors can do an active system instead of a passive optical network, where it's active.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you throw in SFPs, and I guess you still get the same administrative interface.
Right. Yeah. It's just kind of taking the nice auto back end of the traditional PON system and then doing, the standard Ethernet over it. Usually that can be cross vendor. It's obviously not the same as just putting a 2011 out there, but,
it's more like a point to point active SFP deployment versus passive.
Right, so it's going to be more expensive, but I guess ultimately if you're doing a huge install and you want it to be as easy as possible, then their provisioning backend is kind of an interesting solution.
Right, and I don't have too much experience with this other than there was a vendor or an ISP here in my region, and I did a little bit of work for him. He redid his entire network with MikroTik, and he had a PON. I'm using the past tense because he's since went out of business because he was an early adopter, and he built a beautiful bridge to nowhere that he couldn't feed with adequate bandwidth. Mm-hmm. He could carry a gig of multi gigs across town, but then he had a 20 meg bottleneck with his provider, so he was just way ahead of his time. So
you're picking that network up for cheap, I guess.
No, the county wound up with it. Oh. It probably wouldn't hurt to know how to operate it. So
it'd be interesting. I'm sure you're curious just to know how it works, at least.
Yeah, that's a lot of my drive on this is just how does it work? You know, how would I do it if I ever had the opportunity to do it? That's kind of where I'm at with it right now. And I've been working on a project for one of the local municipalities where there may be the possibility of bringing some transport up from a carrier hotel and aggregating that for multiple ISPs in our region. So,
gotcha. I think another piece that people don't always think about with PON networks is like multi-tenant dwellings or office buildings. So Mike up there in kind of the Chicago area, a lot of those buildings that just go vertical. I see that as being kind of a good opportunity for rewiring those buildings, as opposed to pulling just tons of copper nowadays. It's from what I understand, it's getting a lot more price competitive to just pull fiber inside, you know, a building, throw some PON equipment in there. I haven't actually talked to anybody doing it, but I've been considering pricing it for a couple of different projects just to see how it stacks up. Have you seen any of that, Mike?
I haven't seen it specific to multi-tenant facilities, but for doing, you know, single-family homes, the bulk of the price is in the labor, which is the same whether you're pulling fiber or copper. If you're spending the time, why do you put in something that's 100 years old? Why not just start with fiber?
Yeah, and you know what? Miller and I went to this Gigabit Summit thing a little while back, and he's slapping himself. So this was basically a room full of pimps telling us that we needed their fiber prostitute and why it was so much better than our old copper one, you know? And, you know, they had their silk hats on. But seriously, it was very polarizing. So there was a handful of guys like us, like smaller guys representing smaller ISPs. And
free.
Yeah, there weren't many of us. And then there were people that were like giant cities shopping, gigabit to the home providers. So really the big three, like Google, AT&T, and Verizon Fast. But anyway, talking to these guys, one of the questions I think I asked was, you know, so fiber, you know, they keep saying fiber. You have to have fiber. Future-proof it fiber. Fiber is the only way to do it. Fiber, fiber, fiber. So pull single mode, and it'll work from now till forever. And then to that, my question was, you know, we keep seeing all these optimizations in copper, you know. So right now with, you know, Cat5e, we can get gigabit speeds. We really can, you know. So they're saying gigabit is, you have to have the fiber, but you don't really need to. And so, started out at 10, went to 100 gig, and now there's a 10 gig Ethernet standard, and they just keep stretching it out, you know. You just keep being able to pull more out of it. So what facilities do you expect to see where Cat5e carrying a gig isn't going to be acceptable in the future? So even if video stream at like 4K in an average home,
16 megs per second.
So that's what I'm saying. Are you really going to be running 7 TVs at once pulling individualized streams? You know, right. So it's just, I don't know.
Some of the customers that we represent probably, yeah.
Yeah. So, but
it's I think it's more of a buzzword marketing thing than it is a practicality standpoint. Of saying a gig versus 100 meg, like, just sounds a little more impressive. Yeah. And that's what keep bantering, even though nobody needs it.
Yeah, and there was some of the guys talking. It was really just big marketing thing, but they were talking about how they had this, I think it was in Florida, it was some kind of new condo development thing, and their big thing was they pulled fiber into the whole thing, and they're really selling it as, you know, this high technology facility and everything. So I guess they're really using it more as a marketing tool as opposed to delivering services. But
we've done that too.
Does that really work though? Does that entice people in? I don't know.
There's this whole mystique of it right now. I'm dealing with this with this political thing that's going on where they don't understand it. It's like black magic. And I truly, you know how Justin likes to call himself, or Justin Wilson likes to call himself, a network shaman? I really felt like that the other day when I was trying to explain this. They just looked at me like I was from another planet, and they were doing this.
You know what's funny is, like, things will make sense in my head, and I'll say them out loud, and people look at me like I, you know, just crapped the bed. So I've started using metaphors a lot. Like, I'm constantly using metaphors, and I actually had a guy yell at me. He goes, "I don't want your damn metaphors," when I was explaining something. He was a little upset. Obviously, at the time. Yeah, but I just thought it was hilarious. I guess he thought I was demeaning him by trying to make it so that he could understand it.
I use metaphors constantly. Like, it's just how I communicate with anybody. And I always try to explain it like water hoses and fire hydrants. And, I mean, I spend my
series days, of tubes.
Yeah.
It's the, like, best metaphor I've heard this... The best metaphor I heard this week was bees with machine guns. Denial of service attack.
Bees with machine guns.
I think it's an Amazon app. You can do it for stress testing your website. I just heard about it during the week, and I was kind of like, who thinks up this? And then some guy goes, smart people. Okay.
Bees with machine guns.
It wasn't how you thought.
It wasn't bees. Not nearly so cute.
Yeah. But but talking about the point-to-point versus the, you know, in optical terms, in the UK, a customer of mine, they were kind of pioneers in terms that they were a small private operation doing it in rural broadband. I'm talking about one house every 200 or 300 or 400 meters, you know, so it's kind of, or yards, sorry. So it's much more, for the Americans out there, but it was much more spread out, and it was, you know, less dense than, let's say, what Mike would be dealing with in Chicago. And what they actually found was the point-to-point stuff, that when they were doing the cost-benefit analysis per port, that they were saying, like, they could get it at around, maybe, I think they were talking about $50 per port, $50 per port. You know, when they were taking into account, you know, provisioning for a client. So the infrastructure costs that they were actually accounting for was around $50 per subscriber, which was pretty attractive for one that, you know, wouldn't have to be upgraded for quite some time. And also probably could be just replaced by two SFPs at either end, and you're jumping up an order of magnitude of bandwidth. And his argument against the GPODs was, he was just saying that because you're contending the capacity, you're actually reducing the value of your installation, you know, with the single fiber. But I do like JJ's point. Like, I wasn't aware that you could actually have multiple channels. Mm-hmm. So you could have your DWDM as well as your PON as well, which is kind of a nice way of maximizing the use of the single strand.
Yeah. So, like, in the...
Yeah, and that's where some of the WDM PON guys that have started to reintroduce that system have been targeting their stuff, is to be aggregating multiple PONs, wavelengths, you know, serving multiple neighborhoods all onto one fiber. So then you've got, you know, each set of 32 homes or 64 homes coming together. And then you bunch 16 of those all onto one, you know, strand, and then haul it off.
So normally like when you're doing an add drop mux, it comes in, hits the prism, and it'll split out to the different wavelengths. And then you have an active SFP or a colored SFP that will break that out, you know, so it'll send and receive on specific wavelengths, right? So you've got different wavelengths with different ones. So if you're going to do that out in the field, I'm assuming you have to have something active out in that neighborhood, right? A pedestal somewhere that's going from colored to a gray optic, or just a regular Ethernet to shoot out to each one of those.
I didn't look into those particular ones too closely, but something would have to convert, because each of those 16 neighborhoods are going to have the same wavelength. Per subdivision. So then something's going to have to convert.
Yeah. You're going to have something active somewhere out there in the field.
I don't I don't know whether it's active or if they have some sort of passive device that will just change the wavelength.
I know a lot of the ONUs that I've been looking at do have tunable optics, so you can just go in and reprovision the customer up to a different wave. Or if you're running active electronics, say a pedestal or something, then you could provision your backhaul over to a different wave or even over to a different strand, you know. Because you get into optical switching or the optical, electrical, optical stuff, and it's all kinds of really cool stuff that I wish I could, you know, buy tomorrow.
Yeah, and I've heard some arguments on that. So say you are serving 64 clients off of a pond, and then you have 16 of those, right? So, I mean, 64 times 16, that's a lot of customers coming off of one strand. What happens if that gets cut? And in my experience, if you get a cut on a fiber cable, it's not just going to break one strand, it's going to break them all. Usually a backhoe does a pretty darn good job of chewing through backhoe attenuation. Usually it does a pretty good job of going all the way through the fiber. So I think in that instance, the only real
is protected
true answer to that, yeah, is another fiber cable taking a different route. From what I understand, and the experience I've had with it, a lot of people will have kind of a ring around. So if this is your service area right here, you have a ring that goes around the county and sort of tries to touch in different places and come in if you can, which is great about the passive stuff. So, or the optimal muxing, whether you're doing coarse wave or dense wave, even though it's one fiber, it can that one color, that one wavelength is virtually a point-to-point back to your head end. So it just gives you a lot more capabilities off a single strand.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. Kind of stepping back to something Tom said a minute ago, just popped into my head about his crack on the on the Imperial system and metric system there. I seen a meme the other day that kind of cracked me up. It had a flag of Neil Armstrong hopping across the moon in front of the American flag that happens to be up there. and it said the metric system. It said, "What was it? Metric system? Whose flag's on the moon?" So
the only thing I will say is I heard a vicious rumor that NASA actually used the metric system now, and it may have something to do with. Sorry about that. That's my boss prompting me and asking me questions. Sorry, and telling me to say this. No, actually, she's not saying that. Sorry. So basically, yeah, apparently it wasn't a failed mission to Mars, and it was because the European Space Agency and the Americans were working on the project, and someone was working on the proposal, and someone was working on guidance, and they were using a slide rule or something to do the conversions, and effectively it kind of, instead of going into orbit around Mars, it went straight. Yeah. Into Mars.
You know, apparently, here in the States, I think it was 50 years or 100 years ago, we officially adopted the metric system, but there was no law put in place to say that we had to stop using the Imperial system. So since nobody forced us to...
If you don't use it.
Yeah, I mean, technically it's our official system, but nobody forced us to, so we don't use it. We just...
It's kind of like the IPv6 Nazis who want to shut down IPv4, so everyone moves IPv6.
Imagine that bandwagon. If I could, if we could get some quality NAT64, you know, I think I'm going to try that strategy at my house.
Is Hotspot working all the way with IPv6 yet?
I don't know. I've not done that. Yeah.
Where's Andrew?
Hotspot scares the crap out of me. All those rules and the firewall and all that magic.
Yeah. Smoking mirrors.
That makes everything work, even though they shouldn't. You know, you kind of go, put in the wrong IP address, it'll still work. And you're like, what? This is impossible.
Yeah, it's all great until the white tiger bites you in the face, right? Is that how that works?
Yeah,
Siegfried and White.
That's our hotspot deployments. The one net pool. Cut that off. Too many problems with that. It would get goofed up, and you'd see the hosts and the IP hotspot hosts, the two addresses we get out of sync, and then one of the twos would get doubled up, and then nothing would work. It was just bad.
Yeah, we saw it turn off the IP pool. Really fix that. Man, I've got like an emergency warning going on over here. What's that? We've got some crazy weather over here. It's probably like a tornado. Flash flood warning. That's okay.
That's better than a tornado.
Yeah, yeah. I'm cool.
Oh, every time it rains in Texas, it's a flash flood.
Yeah, sort of. we're ill-prepared for it. I know every time it rains here, it must be like the way it snows up there. People just lose their minds. Just completely forget how to drive, everything like that. Drop of water. So anyway, the Jeep on Slipbar, do you guys have any plans of actually attempting it in the near future? I know, JJ, you said you were researching, but that's probably for some crazy side project. Okay. So while we're talking about GPON, the other big part of that is people want to do TV delivery over the medium, right? So it's one pipe to feed everything, which is basically like taking your steak, your potatoes, you put in your apple pie, and then you put in your tea, and then you put it in the blender, shake it up, and drink it all at once, right? It's delicious. Everybody loves it like that. But the TV delivery piece for anything but the bigs has been all but impossible lately. I've been doing a ton of research. Have you guys been actually looking at trying to do any IPTV
stuff? My personal attitude is on it that the older generations are the only ones that care about that. And I don't know. I just think that the cost of internet is going to kind of rise and meet that triple play price in the next 15 years.
All right. So I used to think that. So before I started doing all this research coming into it, this is what I thought, right? I watch Netflix a lot. I watch, you know, occasionally Hulu, or I'll stream something online. And I don't even watch TV anymore. Honestly, I don't. So why do I need it, you know? And I bet everybody's going to move to that. Well, then started talking to a lot of the content delivery companies and the mediums and methods that you actually get content rights. And that's not the case. So if you think about it, this is kind of where net neutrality ties all into it. Who actually owns the content that everybody wants, right? So Comcast now owns, what is it, NBC and a bunch of affiliates. And then so a lot of the ISPs and cable companies are actually the ones that own the content production companies. So that means they've got a stranglehold on it. You know, there's not a whole lot of independent stuff. So Netflix has started doing their own independent stuff with, like, Orange is the New Black, and there's that Kevin Spacey show that Tom likes so much. House of Cards. That's right. So there's a little bit of content being delivered, but you know what? 99% of what people want to watch is on these networks that are owned by these giant ISPs.
Amazon has stuff, too, now, too.
Right? And so, yeah, and you know what? A lot of that content's good, but it's just a trickle. You know, I mean, it's just a tiny little bit compared to everything else. And I think, given time, there'll be a switch and a change, but they have it locked down. Another piece is what's keeping cable companies alive are sports networks, right? Sports channels. You can't stream ESPN on the internet, you know, unless you have like a cable provider that allows you to do that or something like that. And from what somebody told me in the organization, they said, Comcast pays us $1.5 billion a year. When you can come to me and offer me anywhere near that kind of money, I'll talk to you about allowing you to stream my content. Right? So that's what it comes down to. They have the stranglehold on the industry. So there are a few organizations put together, like NCTC, that it's like a co-op of cable providers, and you can negotiate content rights, but it ends up the content rights are honestly astronomical when you look at it. So there's all these different ways you can buy all this head-in equipment that will pull in the feeds, mucks it up, spit it out. You know, you get the set-top boxes for like $100. It's great. You know, you have this thing called middleware, which is like your guide channel for people to, you know, figure out which stuff they want to watch, and all that stuff is really great. And you can get a finite price schedule and all that stuff, but then you look at content rights, and so you factor in how much I have to pay for the equipment, content rights, put those together, and I can't compete with anybody anymore. I can't compete with the local cable providers. I can't compete with satellite TV. So if I want to actually do IPTV delivery, there's one company I found who kind of does all the work for you and hands you a feed, and they're called Skitter. And they've been doing a lot of stuff here in Texas lately. But the footprint to jump in there is, and I've got an NDA, so I can't really like say a number, but it's more than $100,000, right, to get in the door. And I think that's pretty much commonly available knowledge, right? So it's fairly hefty. So if you've got a subscriber base of, I don't know, several thousand people, right, then it probably makes sense for you to jump in like that. But if you've got 400 subscribers, you know, say 400 to 900, somewhere in there, which is honestly where the majority of WISPs seem to sit, somewhere in that neighborhood, it's just priced where you can't even compete. And it all comes back to that licensing crap.
And WISPA get a license and have everyone at WISPA.
That would be brilliant. But you know what? So like Skitter, if you sign with them, get a license, you can deliver to this community. And you go to a new community, you don't have to pay another license, right? You can still deliver it over there, which is great. But that entry price, due to all of these content rights, just locks you out, right? And who owns all those content rights ultimately? It's the other big ISPs. And so when you really look at it like that, it's them pretty much acting as a monopoly, squeezing out everybody else, killing the competition. So,
well, I'm glad you mentioned that word competition, because what the feck were the FCC doing with the net neutrality ruling? Like, isn't that the most anti-competitive decision ever made, which was, you know, about net neutrality and, you know, basically saying to Comcast, yeah, you can lock Netflix out. So people on certain cable networks are not free to view content provided through a private contract with another provider on the internet, because the intermediary has decided to effectively censor the content that the person can view. It's very anti-American, very anti-competitive, very anti-free trade. What do you think yourselves?
Well, I mean, I think, who's it, JJ? Or no, Tom, you actually said it perfectly earlier. It's all black magic inside, right? All the way the internet works, nobody has a clue. You know, they don't have a clue how any of this infrastructure gets to them. And so that ignorance is where this stuff is allowed to flourish. You know what I mean?
I mean, absolutely all the time we have customers contact us that I literally think that they believe that the dish out in their yard or on their house pulls internet from the Philotic network, and it doesn't actually travel through, you know, the physical world that we all live in. It just, because, okay, well, why is it broken? Well, lightning hit the tower. Why aren't you fixing it? Because lightning's still hitting the tower.
Yeah, no, I accept that there's a cost associated with the delivery. However, if you have two providers who have invested similarly in infrastructure and you just throw a cable across, you know, it's a patch lead, then why don't they play ball? Like, in the interest of free, the free as in not free as in dollars, but freedom as in the... If you're subscribers, who has the right to steer customers away from one content provider over another? I think from a business perspective, the ISP, the Edge ISP, have a duty of care to make sure that there's free-flowing bandwidth between their customer and a provider of data. And like it or not, those guys are paid to do that fucking job. Excuse the language.
Yeah.
So, and so if there is a cost associated with that, then charge it, but you can't be kind of creating a little tax on what's flowing. I thought that was a bad word in, you know, your part of the world, and but also monopolies and cutting competition out is about, you know, I just think that, you know, the internet has grown where it flourished because of, you know, I suppose that disorganized, free, independent companies collaborating as opposed to competing.
All right. Well, I mean, think about it like this, too. Who loses in this? It's a handful of content providers, like your Netflix. I mean, this is what people immediately see, I think, in my mind, is Netflix and Hulu. And they are these huge billion-dollar corporations. They're getting taxed. So the little guy's like, yeah, screw those hippies, you know. Let them get taxed. I don't care. When ultimately they don't see that it affects them negatively.
Right, and like even right now with the current conditions, the way that it is for myself is a business owner here in the United States, it is incredibly tough to get your foot through the door and get to the point where you can purchase bandwidth from or in quantity enough to get it at decent prices. It's like, okay, well, I want to do a gigabit to everybody's house. Okay, well, in order to do that, you got to have, you know, way more, you know, you got to have more than a gig.
Yeah.
So, and then you say, okay, well, I'm going to sell it to the customer for, I don't know, what will the market bear? And then so you figure that out, and then you go to your providers, and they give you a number, and then you go cry.
Yeah, I know right now in our world, fiber to the home absolutely works in every city if day one I have 5,000 subscribers. If I have them already, then I can go and I can buy that bandwidth cheap, you know, and right. I can do all the quality service. I can make it work and it'll be beautiful and it'll be perfect, but it doesn't work like that. And to put all that freaking infrastructure in the ground, to dump all this fiber and to work through all the political bullshit that's associated with it is a nightmare.
Yes.
Just to know that maybe year one I would have a couple hundred subscribers or better, it just doesn't work. It doesn't financially work, and it's so frustrating. Because if you could get one piece of it to work, until you get to a certain volume, the whole thing is not sustainable. It's crazy. It's like cold fusion, I guess.
Right. You just put a lot of internet first, yeah, apparently. That's the head idea. But, like, no, but if you got a, like, if you have, like, OpenIX, like, what do you think of the OpenIX movement in the US? Is that improving things for, like, say, to allow providers to peer, share bandwidth, reduce transit costs? Like, I believe that was in response to restrictive internet exchanges before. Like, how do you feel about that? Or, like, that's what I'm trying to say is that if you've got two providers that are similarly sized and one is trying to provide content in that the other other provider's subscriber base wants, I just don't see how ISP should be facilitating the flow of information rather than stifling.
I think that there's kind of a twofold on that. One is it would be great if here in the States we had like a nonprofit organization that would go regionally and, you know, just put a footprint in all those data centers and bam, you know, have the internet exchange there, have it ready to go. But two is, brother, we are spread out here in the States. We are so far apart. So if I'm in Texas especially, and my nearest, say, co-location point, meet me point, is going to be in Dallas. And it honestly is. If anybody in Texas wants to hit an exchange, you got to go to Dallas. So if I'm 150, 200, 300 miles away, the transit from point A to point B is going to be so expensive, you know.
Yeah, that's the same battle that we have trying to get to either, you know, either of the telex facilities, either in Charlotte, North Carolina, or Atlanta, Georgia.
So I think if there was a nonprofit in place in those locations, then I think a lot more people could stomach paying that transit cost to get there. But the fact that they have to pay the transit, they have to buy co-location space, they have to pay. And each cross-connect, on average, in these data centers is going to be over $300 a month on each cross-connect.
And lots of times people have to pay it on both ends.
Yep.
Like, so your provider's paying it, that you're paying for transit, and then you got to turn around and pay it. So that's $600 a month just for cross-connect.
A lot of these joints, just to get equipment in the facility, you're paying $1,000 a month. And then you're going to pay to go over to Netflix, you're going to pay, I don't know, $350 a month to go to Google's network, another $300. You want to go to another provider, probably a third, at least to start with. So you're looking at $2,000 a month minimum is what you're going to have to pay just for peering. If you want to pull bandwidth out of there, it's another cross-connect plus the bandwidth fee. And then you're going to have to pay a fairly sizable fee just to backhaul that mess. And so a lot of us, if you're going to hit a meet-me point or a pop, you still got, so say I get a level 3 circuit, and I hit the local pop, I've still got to transport that 60 miles, 100 miles. How am I going to get it there, you know, once it hits that pop? So there's just so many hurdles here that you got to... And that's where, like, the air fibers, I think, are really starting to come in. We're starting to see some more people dump, like, air fibers in those meet-me points, you know, whether it's the original air fibers, the air fiber fives, to get that higher bandwidth, you know, to dump it back. there's still, and here in the WISPs, at least in my area, I've seen there's not a lot of cooperation. So, you know, if I'm successfully, if I'm successfully pulling bandwidth, even if I can make a good margin and profit selling to somebody else, I don't want to help the WISP that's next door to me. So,
I think it depends. Like, I think in Ireland, a lot of the providers will cooperate if they're kind of a safe distance away. Now, fairness, we actually get on well with our neighbors, thankfully, but I've heard of other lads just wouldn't talk to each other. You know, they'd be in the same room and they just, you know, almost ignore each other on purpose, you know, like almost like state, I'm ignoring you. And I'll, you know, but like, no, I'd agree. Like, we have similar costs, but like, I'd find for me, like, when I joined the local internet exchange, that was a big step for our company. And it improved our user experience. So as me as an ISP, with all those costs of being an ISP, that by peering more openly, I was actually improving my subscriber base's usage of the internet and their user experience. And I felt that that was, in a way, a duty of care that I had, a responsibility, bearing in mind the costs. So I have, then my job is to make those costs work, square the circle, if you would. But like, it, I think it's possible to do it.
Yeah, and again, I think that would be tremendous. I think that would be a boon for us.
It's a very tough struggle to get up to the volume of bandwidth, and like what you're saying, like my first bandwidth that I bought was 1 meg, all of 1 meg. I think I contended the living daylights out of that until I said, okay, I need to go to 2 megs. 5 and then 10 and 30, and like now we've got, you know, a gig with Cogent, we've got a gig on INXLAN 1 and we've dropped down to 100 megs on INXLAN 2 because basically it just wasn't getting enough bandwidth. And basically you've got 2 LANs, but most lads join the first LAN and they don't go to the second LAN because of the extra cost. So I actually, you know, I kind of went, oh, I'll go on to the second LAN, but you know, there's like only about 20% of our bandwidth. Even by trying to steer all the traffic through to LAN 2, it still only comes up around 20% of LAN 1. Like, but it was a very hard slog. Like, I mean, I'm what, 8-9 years in business now? 8 years in business, and it's only like last year that we got all that kind of nice stuff and got into a proper colo, and you know. But we have a lot more, I think, carrier neutral. Are a lot of the data, what's the data center landscape like? Like, are all the years carrier neutral, or are carrier neutral really popular, or is it just the big guys controlling all data centers?
Most of ours that I've dealt with are fairly carrier neutral. Carrier neutral is kind of misleading. Neutral
as long as you have as much money as a large carrier.
Well, carrier neutral in that if you pull bandwidth from them, they may give you a break on the cross-connect fee, but, man, they're really going to spank you when you go to anybody else.
Yeah, it's like the largest exchange is going to be Equinix, and they don't sell their own internet service, but they sell cross-connects and this and that and all these other things. And everything is so expensive because they don't sell internet. So they have to make just as much money as the guys that sell internet without selling the internet.
Yeah, so it's basically they get...
They're real estate brokers. I mean, yeah. It's like storage. It's like storage wars.
Yeah, they get their taste, but they don't have to do any of the heavy lifting. So they don't have to worry about maintaining the routers and the infrastructure and the personnel. So it's kind of
you just have to keep the burden building from burning down.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know about up there where you're at, but down here we've had Duke University and NASA doing a weather experiment at 24 gigs, and so the 24 gig unlicensed band. So we had experienced some of that.
What did you see?
It would just go sporadic. Whenever they were blasting away at the sky, it would modulation rates would drop down to virtually nothing, and so, then they just randomly come back.
How did you figure out what it was?
Because they were on the same mountain as us, and they kept moving their antenna around. Like, they just... So I went down and asked, you know, the guy that takes care of the building, so why do they keep turning that antenna around? He's like, oh, they're getting interference. I was like, so am I. So I started looking at the equipment, and, you know, sure enough, right there on it, it said 24-1. And so I contacted them and talked to them. They're like, yeah, we get all this crazy interference all the time, so we've been going up there and moving it over a couple inches trying to figure out what it was. It's like, well, it's me. So, and you're causing interference on me, so stop it.
So you figured out every time you unplugged it, it quit breaking.
Yeah. So I ultimately tightened the channels up and kind of wiggled out of the way because I didn't need Uber speed.
So you wouldn't have duplex on 24-2, probably.
Yeah.
I can't wait for somebody to listen to this on, you know, just on a podcast, just the audio version of Justin, this and this and that.
This.
Yeah, oh, Sam gets so mad at me because I say this and that and over there so much. He's like, yeah. I have no idea what you're even talking about.
Those Air Fiber 24s, they don't generate the signal at a lower frequency and up band it, do they? Or is it just natively?
Zero IF, so...
Because I know the...
So in other words, it doesn't have intermediate frequency, so that's kind of their claim to fame.
Okay, because doesn't like the Ubiquiti like 5 gigahertz stuff, don't they generate it 2.4 and upband it to 5 or something like that?
I'm not sure. I've not got to take one apart, so I don't know.
It's the 365 and the 900 are just up or down. Well, obviously the 900 is down, but the 365 is either up converted 2.4 or down converted 5.
Yeah, they're putting transverters on the cheap silicon so that they can get it to a different frequency.
Yeah, but
I think on the Air Fiber, since it's custom, you know, from the ground up, they built it specifically at 5.
You still have the Air Fiber 5 running?
Yes.
How's that working out for you?
It's pretty awesome.
So we got
what sort of range do you get?
We're about to put up.
Very nice. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. I mean, it's been up. It's just rock solid. The length, the way I have it configured, is 20 by 10 megahertz, and I've got 200 coming up to the tower and 100 megs going back down. And this particular link, I usually have about 100, 110 megs on it during peak hours, and it's just awesome. I'm very happy with it. And this is a 12-mile link, and at 20 megahertz, I am seeing 8X, you know, the 256 QAM. So
we've.
I mean, without seeing a diagram, I'm going to pull a Greg on this one.
Show me a picture.
Picture.
Unless you draw the whole network out like this.
Unless your paths are like totally balanced, that we found it like difficult. Like, but the CSPF, OSPF with MPLS has been traffic engineering has been pretty nice. And what you can do is statically define the path. So you can take a slightly longer one around, and that. So what we do is, it kind of gets complicated though, because if you have, let's say, if you had two redundant hops ahead of you, you need 4 paths. If you've got 3, you need 8 paths. You know, to work out all the, if you wanted to statically define all your paths. So what we normally do is pick 2 primary paths, and then the third path we just say, yeah, do your OSPF thing. But it's pretty tedious because you have to specify each IP address of each interface on each router. So if you've got you'll have 2 hops, you'll have 2 IPs per hop. So it can kind of, your list can get very long. But it actually is working pretty well, to be fair to MikroTik. We were using CSPF, or we had turned on MPLS through OSPF for ages on our network, and we just weren't using it. So then I said, okay, let's get this traffic engineering working. But you know, I suppose the issues I kind of ran into with that was, you know, you can have one of the routers misconfigured, or if you misconfigure the tunnel and begin with, and then you make the changes, it mightn't come up. Then you delete the tunnel, put it in right, and then it works, you know. So, but it's been very stable since it came up. And I just got like I think for Justin, for what you're trying to do, where you're trying to load balance and links, you can be very granular about it. So if sites are pretty close to your backhaul, you can let them kind of go a slightly longer route. And then the guys who are in the outlying part of your network, you can push them through the most direct.
Well, I can say what I've done so far with the Air Fiber link is this. I put this Air Fiber in on an exact path that I already had some like a pair of rockets and a couple of 2-foot dishes. And so on this particular path, I left the rockets just in case lightning or the air fiber was a piece of junk. You know, before I knew, you know, I just bought it on a hope that it was actually going to work out of the box, and it did. I mean, I ordered it straight from Ubiquiti when they first started selling them on their website. You know, they airshipped some in. It said Air China all over the box, and or the boxes. I mean, it was like the boxes were, you know, apartment refrigerator size boxes. I'm just using manipulating OSPF costs because at this point, MPLS for my network, I've tinkered around with it, but I've not found a valid use for it at this point I guess we've just not reached that level of maturity yet.
I think a lot of times too, it's, you know, keep it simple. The fewer things you have running, the less there is to go wrong. Fewer bugs you're gonna pop into. Oh, Tom,
my
your colleagues face.
Are going to love you guys, and they're going to say, "See, Tom, I told you so."
But yeah. No. We're not all we're not all as advanced in our network knowledge and all that stuff as Tom is. So.
That was going great. I actually, in fairness, I remember doing the training, my first INE course, and I was going, oh Jesus, I have to teach this tomorrow. And I ended up looking at Greg's cog. So, thank you, Greg.
I'm definitely sure Greg's taught us all a little bit of something.
Yeah.
So
I was trying to convert a Cisco 7975 Cisco phone to SIP, and I was Googling, and here comes Greg's blog. Here's how to do it. Here's how to do the provisioning.
You know, I just put that stuff up so that I could remember how to do it myself.
So yeah.
It's basically just my Cliffs notes, that's all.
You know, lots of times I will be just Googling something random, and it'll be, you know, here's Greg or here's Andrew. So I just need to go search their websites first, and then...
then ask Google.
There you go. No, man, you gotta just keep doing that and then clicking on me. That way it, like, bumps me up. Just keeps me up there at the top. Keeps my ego boosted up. That's the only reason I do it.
The one thing I'll say about traffic engineering, because I tried LDP-based MPLS, and I would advise you to steer clear of that. It doesn't work that well. I learned that the hard way, because, you know, MikroTik support guns, and they said, yeah, just use the OSPF-based one. But one thing that's nice about it, compared to, let's say, OSPF, where you have your costs on each link. So if one link is, you know, one metric slightly longer, then you won't get your balance, you know, that kind of way. So it can be very hard to just manipulate the traffic so you're balancing equally. And then you have the problem, which we have with any, I suppose, MikroTik link, where one link might perform at, you know, 220 megs, and then a similarly configured link might only perform at 140 megs. So you do your bandwidth testing, say, I've got 220 on that, happy days. Like, one of the things that we found was the 800s with the newer PCI Express interfaces were pretty, rather than the old R52HNs. We saw a bump in performance, and actually, just something to, I was trying out the last time I was talking to you, I think, or we were saying about the 30 meg channels. What we've noticed is there's a lot more noise sensitivity, like your smoke ping graphs can go up quite considerably. And then when we actually brought them back down to 20 meg channels, the actual noise, you know, the actual jitter went away. So it's just something that I don't know if you...
You know, I noticed that as well, and then they came out with that wireless FP, you know, the new driver, and I started kicking that on all my MikroTik links, and that is amazing. Like, I don't know what they did. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, the new wireless driver running MV2, they've just about got it right. So...
Except the fact that it's not DFS certified, so I can't actually use it.
What are you talking about?
Of course. JJ's talking about it in the lab that he was testing. No.
5.8 would be fine. But Metro Chicago, like, you know, got to use 5.4. And then again, be Metro Chicago, the whole TWR radars and whatnot, I can't run something not certified because they'll see it. $10,000, $20,000. So,
just put your competitor's name on the box.
Yeah. Just stay away from 5650 and 5600. There you go.
Yeah.
Those guys in Puerto Rico can't seem to figure that out. Every 6 months, someone down there gets fined.
Yeah, I've been watching that too. All that stuff comes out in the amateur radio books too. All the FCC fines get published.
Where's that? Down in San Juan. Every 6 to 9 months, some new WISP, because Gino said there's like dozens of them in the same town, and they all just buy stuff on the internet, put it up, and then if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And so they just put it at 5180 and 5650, and because those are free channels, so why not use them? And the FCC comes by and says $28,000, please. then they decide maybe they shouldn't do that anymore.
Can I ask a question? Because I haven't touched the Air 5s yet. But what's, let's say, the maximum speed you get, let's say, with just 20 meg channel space? What would you get, with the 256 QAM? What sort of bandwidth would you get, and what sort of range at that?
Channels. Well, this... Go ahead, Jess.
It's one channel or two channels, right? It's either half or full duplex. So if you only have 20 megahertz channel, that's one channel.
Could you do 10 megahertz and 10 megahertz?
Yes, the new firmware does let you split the transmit and the receive if you're running full duplex. So like the
can you do like one up here, one down here? Like one in 50, whatever. Like can you have a gap in between them?
Yes, you can have a gap, and I found in my testing that you need about 50, at least 50 to 75 megahertz between your transmit and receive if you're running them in full duplex mode. If you get them closer than that, then you start seeing degradation on the symbol rate. And then if you're running in the United States, if you're running DFS radios, you will see that you can't run the full transmit power on the Uni One, I can't remember what it is off the top of my head.
Uni two.
So 5,400 megs down in that neighborhood, you're limited to a crippled ERP. So if you're looking at long links on these DFS compliant radios, then you have to stay up in 5.7 in the U.S., which can be that band may already be contested where you're at. So it can be tough, but we did find a solution that worked using 30 total for full duplex. So the direct question or the direct answer, excuse me, about to call, I guess the most direct answer that I could give you is, depending on the distance of the link, let's say it's just 12 miles, like the one that I have, at 20 megahertz, I can run 256 QAM. I don't know how much further beyond 12 miles I'd be able to maintain the 8x modulation rate, which is the 256 QAM. I don't think it would be very far, personally. I think that maybe another 3 miles, 15 miles, and you're probably going to be pushing it on a 20 meg channel. But 200 megabits in a 20 megahertz channel is what you're going
to
get.
You also have to remember JJ's up in the mountains too, so his shots, I mean, they really are free space. You don't have to worry about obstructions and stuff, right?
Yeah, there's nothing. It's just it's wide open. No Fresno issues, no nothing. I mean, it's basically as picture perfect for long distance as you can get. We even mounted the one on the roof of the data center closer to the edge just to get away. We did notice they're hypersensitive to reflections. So if you're in the middle of a roof versus the edge of a roof, you will see degradation on your symbol rate. Where we noticed when we pushed it to the edge of the roof versus where we had it originally in the center, we were getting weird modulation dropouts. And then we just moved the antenna 20 feet to the edge of the roof, and the problems went away. The building was maybe 30 foot tall. And then the tower, of course, is, you know, we're only about 30 foot up the tower, and but the tower is at 6,000 feet, so it doesn't, and it's just a beautiful view. Yeah, that's exactly what the path looks like. It's just straight up like that. It's a very easy path.
That also kind of breaks my brain that you can, one direction you can go 10 megahertz, and the reverse direction you can do 20 megahertz, right?
Yeah. So, and the configuration can be extremely complex on the AF5s, because not only do you have, you can go 10 megahertz or 20 megahertz or soon to be 30 or 40 or 50. So you play with all these different widths. And for me, 40 drops me down. I get more throughput, but I get dropped down into 6X at 12 miles. So that means I'm down at QAM 64, so my throughput is cut in half. So I'm only getting like 304 or 302 megabits at 40, where if I were a little bit closer at 40 megahertz, I would get more. So they're, you know, gigabit advertising. You know, it'd be 500 megahertz or 500 megabits in both directions. If you were, say, I don't know, I think anything over about 6 miles, you're never ever going to see a gigabit on air fiber fives. But I don't have a short link like that, and that would be running 250 megahertz channels. So in essence, the entire band, or yeah, the entire upper band.
Six miles, that's pretty good. So if you're going to do fiber to the home in a metro area, you could just air fiber five it out to your community and then pawn it.
Well, when you get into metro, you're going to, your frequency at 5 gigs is already going to be contested. So it's kind of like this double-edged sword of, yes, it's awesome, but it's, I've seen some people on the forum calling it an air hog. So... the Air Hog 5. So I kind of got a chuckle out of that. But for my application, it's perfect. You know, there's nothing else that I've used that I'm getting a true 200 megabits on that 12 mile hop. And
check out that screenshot I just sent to you guys.
It says it may contain viruses. Are you sending me a virus?
From my Mac, yeah.
Gosh, it's not working.
I'm not going to pull it up.
We recently deployed.
It's a scan that I did it on 5 gig. 80 stations found.
Wow. Ouch. But largely, it's working beautiful for us. I'm very happy with the product, but I don't think that it's not a magic bullet that cures every long distance links throughput issues. Because if you already have a lot of APs on a tower, I had to do some serious frequency juggling and scooch things away from the frequencies that I was using here. And this thing, the air fibers will absolutely crush Air Max and MicroTik APs. They'll just drop all their clients and say, I don't hear anybody, if you're not very careful. So
we had, when we were doing the experiments with the custom frequencies, we ended up doing an Excel spreadsheet. So I broke up the 5 gigahertz spectrum into 5 megahertz blocks and then had to map it out. Like, it took me ages. But it was a worthwhile exercise, because you ended up kind of being more efficient, where you were trying to give loads of space between sectors. You kind of said, well, they don't have to be that far apart. We can kind of squeeze them a bit closer together, uh-huh, and we can fit in 40 megs or 50 megs or 60 megs of contiguous channel space. And hopefully we can hold it. But we recently deployed it, like, you know, with the Juris dishes, the 800s with the R52HNs, and we were getting around 220 meg with the FP package, which I was amazed at, on a 2040. So it was a 40 meg channel, dual chain. So obviously it was probably not comparing like with like, considering you were just doing a 20 meg channel with whatever technology the Air Fibers right. have. Yeah.
The Air Fiber is also running a 23 dB dish because since it is a turnkey, pull it out of the box, turn it on solution, the only legal, the only truly legal size of antenna they could run with the emitter powers they have for the 23 dB. So in my mind, it would have made more sense if they had made a couple of antennas and then made a transmitter module that you then assembled as the consumer. And I've actually joked around with Sam about, why don't we make some 3-foot dishes with some waveguide fees and you just order one and unbolt the radio and bolt it onto the antennas. So,
but you would never actually do that, right? Of course not.
Only in the upper band.
Right. And you'd test it in your lab and that would be it, right?
Well, no, at 5.7, you can do whatever, you know, you got unlimited antenna gain thanks to WISPA still, you know?
Very cool.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, how'd you get that across the line?
Right? So you guys are, we only have a small chunk where we can, run unlimited gain.
It's over a 125 megahertz section. In a point-to-point mode, you can run. I think the baseline is a 30 dB transmitter into a 6 dB antenna. But then there is, no antenna gain restrictions. You can slap it onto a 12-foot dish.
Right, and that's where you say, well, I thought the waveguide had like 40 decibels of loss.
Oh yeah,
but I mean, it makes sense though because as you increase the gain of the antenna, it's decreasing the beam width, so there's a smaller and smaller section that you could possibly interfere with.
Right,
so exactly, and larger antennas actually cause less interference abroad. But the problem is, I heard some, tower hands the other day making fun of small dish guys, saying that they had no place on towers and this, that, and the other. And, I guess because they're afraid, because they bring out cranes and hang 12-foot dishes all over these towers. And then I'm up here with my Tonka truck and my... and my Tinker Toys.
They're just compensating for something.
There you go. They're insane. They zip line out of the top of these towers like it's something else to watch these crews work. So there's all kinds of new stuff. Like Ubiquiti, they launched their new website, and then Microtik, we've got some pictures that Andrew shared.
Dug around in the FCC docs. So if you look in there and you search for the Microtik code, it'll show you all the stuff they have submitted with pictures and some descriptions and information and stuff. I actually have his little screenshots pulled up. Let's see if we... He's got the metal, and then he's got the map in there.
I'm excited about that. That's a nice little fun toy.
I think it's cool. If you look at it, though, if you look at the screenshots and the internals... Like up in the top right corner, I'm assuming that's the antenna, and it's about the size of a dime.
Yes.
So it is really small. I think you can probably get coverage for probably like 15 feet and lower your sperm count. I think that's about all it's good for. But it looks really cute. I can't wait to get one. I'm not gonna lie.
No, Microtik. It'll probably be a 3-watt PA on that.
I think it may be based on a TP like an Atheros reference design, because there's actually a few TP-Link access points similar to that.
I've seen them.
And in fact, Ripe actually used them for. I don't know if you've ever heard of Ripe Atlas, where you can get these free probes, which are little TP-Link access points with a 4 gig flash. They load a version of Linux on it, and it dials back to a server, and you can ping all sorts of probes around the internet and just do measurements like of bandwidth, latency, jitter. So, it's pretty cool. Like, they got some really cool stats about how when Hurricane Sandy hit New York, that a lot of European customers lost internet connectivity. Because they were routing, like the likes of Cogent tend to trombone via New York, you know, when they're not getting, when peers in Europe aren't playing ball with them and saying, no, we don't want to link with you there. Go via New York, you know? Yeah. So, you know, but so there's a lot of that, like, it's interesting. Sorry. Anyway, go on ahead. Sorry.
No. So it's not the prettiest thing, but I think it's something that they've needed for ages. So it's obviously a competitor for the Unify stuff. And now that they have the controller package at least released.
Caps, man.
Yeah, it's still really beta, I'm sure.
But. I'm waiting for the RB850G2 GX, something like that. It's the 450 form factor with the
yes, that thing looks nice.
Dual core PowerPC.
It's got like the Scorpion CPU. I looked it up a while back. It's going to be a nice little router.
Yeah, yeah.
$9 for it, supposedly.
What's the price tag on that?
$129.
Man, that is killer.
Yeah. They need to start putting that CPU on the 493s and the 433s and all that. Get rid of those MIPS.
I think one of the other interesting things they had was the cloud router switch. Is that the one? So, yeah, so it's got the wireless, it's got 8 ports, it's got a SFP slot.
They'll probably sell that for like $70, I bet.
The CRS? I bet it's going to be... It just blows my mind that they have a SFP Plus, so it's got a 10 gig interface on this thing.
The Ubiquiti switches look pretty nice.
Yes, I'm very impressed with how those look. I would be excited to use one.
Greg?
I would... I'm going to say anything.
It does look like a...
Nothing to see here. Move along.
Yeah. I do have some details on them. And I would love to actually put one in my hands and play with it. But they're supposedly... they're going to be PoE on all the ports. Whatever the compliance is after AF compliant, I can't remember anymore.
AT and AF.
Yeah, there you go. So it can support higher wattage is basically what it means. And it does the, what is that, phantom power? Mm-hmm. They still like to call it ghost power, but it's phantom power.
Ghostbusters.
Yeah, and so it's supposed to be able to support 24 and 48 volt in the same switch. So you can have a 24 volt AP right here, and then on the next port, 48 port. Which I think is really cool. So it's
according to the stuff that I've read, it said that the 48 volt ATAF standard is auto sensing, and then the 24 volt, you know, it would be manual. So you'd have to enable that the passive 24 volt manually. So,
That's really cool.
And then it looks like from digging around on the internet, the street price for the top of the end or the top of the line 750 watt 48 port. Two SFP pluses, two SFPs, according to their documentation, was it 70 gigabits per second non-blocking? But $999 is the top-end router, is MSRP, and then each one below that is $200 less. With the lowest, the 24-port, 250-watt guy, I think it was $250. I'm just pulling this out of my brain, was $399. So...
Gotcha. So this is going to be more like, especially that top end, more like a high density Unify environment, I guess.
Yeah, or maybe a mixed phone Unify. I'm sure with their phone platform. I mean, their phone platform is, you know, they've got the Unify phone platform. They've kind of put a little bit of information on their new website.
Oh, have they actually started talking about the phones?
Yeah, well, they on the website they put it up. If you look real closely, there's some Easter eggs like on their website if you pay real close attention, and the phone platform is one of those Easter eggs. Like if you go to I think Enterprise, the Easter egg that I'm talking about is right there when you go to their website and click on Enterprise. They got www.wan, LAN, wireless LAN, video, MFI, and they're all like lit up blue. And then they got VoIP, which is still like,
soon. Yeah.
So, So there's that. That's it looks cool. Like they're going to have a phone platform.
Well, that's interesting. That'll be interesting to see. I definitely want to play with those as well. So yeah. Have you seen anything about the management interface for the Switches? Is it all unified based or like controller based or I'm sure it's going to have a CLI, right?
Yeah, according to the website, it says industry standard CLI, so I'm sure it's just going to be a direct Cisco ripoff.
Cisco, like, that's fine.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's not, I don't even necessarily call it, I mean, it really is industry standard now. I mean, that's.
Right. And then it looks like it'll be, from the screenshots that I've seen, it looks like it'll be very similar to the current Tough Switches on how you would configure VLANs from the GUI. It looks like they just kind of borrowed that code, maybe moved it straight over, or borrowed some of that code. It definitely looks, the screenshots look to have more of an EdgeMax feel, so I would say that the EdgeMax programmers are responsible for this.
But you tried any of the MiFi MPower stuff for tower deployments for power control?
I have not.
No,
but I know the in-wall stuff looks sexy.
I got some of that MFi stuff really early, and I haven't used it much since because I want something significantly larger. I want a 24 or a 48 port MFi. They have a 2.
I got a bunch of it early as well, and one thing I thought was a little bit lacking were the automation capabilities. So, you know, having like being able to build in triggered events. So if this and this do this kind of thing, there wasn't really that capability. It was more like monitor so you can look at graphs and maybe send an email on a couple of events.
So I think what you're talking about, I think it has come down the pipe, or at least has improved. I haven't used it lately, but.
So another Easter egg that I noticed on the website was a complete unification of all their enterprise products. And it looks like they have they've got screenshots all over their new website of a brand new interface for everything that's labeled Unify. So the camera system, the phone system, the MFIs. So I think the direction that they're moving, which is, in my opinion, a good direction, is making it just a more unified. I think they're going to have one package that you install that does all of it. And if you pay real close attention to the pictures, it's like, I've never seen that software before, and I use Unify every day.
Finally out of beta on the 3, right?
3.2?
3.2.1. Yeah, multi-site on that. That just, we do all level 3 adoption on all the APs, and we manage probably 10 sites right now for different customers using Unify. That's awesome.
One controller or multiple controllers?
One controller installation, and then we're just managing multiple sites from that.
And I've got multiple controllers virtualized in ESXi, and I've got to merge them all into one.
Gotcha.
Controller now, and have multiple sites. That's going to be a fun project at some point.
You'll probably write some Python script that does it all.
I'll probably just. Forget all the APs and readopt them on the 3.
Gotcha.
It might be easier.
I had to do that when I moved into the new controller, and what I wound up doing was winboxing into the MikroTik router I had there, and then SSHing into each AP from the MikroTik, and then
you can do the remote upgrade on them and wipe them twice and
adopt. Yep.
I was gonna say just SSH in, and then. Could you just set the inform statement to the new controller?
Yeah, but I didn't have I didn't want to do all the port forwarding and all that, so I just did the SSH from the MikroTik and made it so easy. So
yeah, just VPN into it and go from there.
Yeah, well, no, I just opened Winbox and then opened
Terminal.
Yeah, just one at a time.
Yeah.
So I deployed it the 3.2.1 in a huge environment. I'm sure you guys know where I put it right. Not too long ago. And it was really clean upgrade. I didn't lose a single AP, maybe had to reboot manually one or two, maybe three the most out of, say, 300. So I think that's fairly successful.
Yeah, that is very.
Yeah, and they've hidden some firmware, some pretty substantial firmware updates in there. So I would say definitely looking at going if you guys haven't.
Yeah, when I'm I've from the beta program, I've been running 3.2 forever. You know, I just even on the production APs because the 2 was not getting it done for me. I would have a lot of Apple devices would just they just wouldn't connect. It would say, you know, it wouldn't work right, and I just updated every time there was an update. I'd say, okay, yeah, update them all. We'll just wait for the phone calls.
Yes.
Also, it was very smooth. So,
they did a problem. I've been running 3.2.1 for a while, and for the July 4th weekend, I had a whole bunch of family over, and I have a guest SSID that's rate limit, but open, so that way you know anyone can just hop on and use it. But then I go in, if it's people that I like, I you know turn bandwidth up to unlimited, and I discovered that that didn't actually work. I would set someone to unlimited, do a speed test, and I would get less than the upload of the lower limit on the download side, and then the upload side would be just enormously huge, but then they have like a 2-second ping. I changed SID to unlimited. Everybody's pulling 20 megs down, 20 megs up in 10 milliseconds.
So the individual bypass, for some reason, is a little weird.
Yeah.
On my deployments, I never use any of the stuff for the Unify, the walled garden, I don't use that, or the limit or anything like that. I just do it all in the Microtech.
I just did a hospitality network, and I did the, what do they call it, the guest... Not the portal, but the guest access. I'm doing the layer 2, I guess, you know, stopping broadcast traffic, and then also the only RFC space that they can get to is the gateway, and then I'm doing hotspot on a Microtik, and that's working gangbusters. It's doing awesome.
Yeah. I think whenever you enable guest access, it disables, it kills like broadcast. I think it kills multicast. And it does like client isolation, so they can't talk to each other. So it's nice. So it's basically it just throws a bunch of firewall rules on the access point.
Yeah, I logged in and looked at the config, and it was just a whole bunch of. I mean, I seen what they were doing, and it's nice.
Yeah. I guess people don't realize, but it's not all magic. You can actually SSH into the device and see all the configs they stuck on there.
Yeah. So that's what I've been doing to learn what you know when I click that button, what's it doing. It's nice that when you click that button that you can, you know, you can mess up all your APs at once.
With great power comes great responsibility.
There you go. And then on the more Ubiquiti stuff, I guess their claim to fame or their after their, you know, everything that is really important to us wireless ISPs is, you know, they announced the AirMax AC with their Air Prism, so
well re-announced. They announced it 8 months ago, and now they're saying, "Hey, we did this. You already did that."
Yeah. Well, I also saw that in the latest release candidate from Microtik, they added support for 2, I think, Intel AC chipsets.
That's cool.
So that's. I mean, and I googled the cards, and it looks like the cards that support it average about $100 to $120.
Very nice.
So it's not
that new. They have that new radio too. It's the whole board with the three.
DSPs
on the top of it.
Oh yeah, the Scorpion processor based one.
Yeah, it's got like a 720 megahertz processor in it.
Yeah, who's making 3x3 dishes?
Good point.
Maybe RF elements. You think?
I'm not sure.
Wireless, maybe. I don't know.
The only one I know of is.
I know that Chicago 2012 Ubiquiti showed up there with some devices that were probably not supposed to be there, and one of those devices was a 3-chain titanium radio, and they've not said another peep about that. So I would personally suspect that they're having problems keeping the oscillation at distance on the 3-chain radios.
That's was the route?
opinion.
Router board 953GS-5HNT.
God, I wish they would just come out with names like...
Like cars. Yeah.
Yeah.
Camaro.
Even though I'm not going to use it, that's probably my favorite the new Microtik product.
This thing has SFP slots on it.
Yeah, that's exactly why I love it. It's an AP with SFPs so that you can isolate...
Mini PCI Express card slots.
It's you can isolate the data from the power, so that way all your lightning doesn't go down into your switch. It goes into a dedicated DC plant. It's just so much nicer to do it SFPs, but that's the only AP that has it. It's really common for licensed radios, but no one else in the cheap space does it.
Okay, so I've seen Mike say this a couple of times about the Rocket AC to jump around a little bit more. The Rocket AC Lite, I guess is what they're calling it. Does it or does it not have the air prism in it?
No. Moore says no.
Okay.
And Ben Moore also says it's only point to point for now.
Got it.
It sounds like it will firmware upgrade to multi point. But for Air Prism, it would definitely be different hardware.
Okay. So I guess that's the reason they stuck the word light on it. They probably just took the board out of the Unify AC and stuck it in there.
Its list price, I believe, is $135.
Okay.
So it's a lot less than an AC Unify.
Not to jump around even more, but any news on the Mimosa stuff?
For people that don't have NDAs, I guess that's what he means.
Yeah, I don't have anything new to say, but it looks to be really nice.
The pictures are very pretty.
How nice is nice?
Mind melting.
If I ask you three times, will you give in and just give us the raw hard facts?
I think they have a little. There's some public information on the.
There's some public information.
Is the public information optimistic or pessimistic?
Oh, it's optimistic. Or realistic. I guess for all the guys listening that don't know what they're talking about, Mimosa's a new wireless manufacturer that's going to be coming out. Who are going to be competing in the kind of the WISP space? Who is it? What are these? Who were the guys, the money men that came from this?
They're the guys, Polycom guys.
Polycom, that's right. Polycom guys. So they supposedly they're not using like Atheris chipsets. They're not using the Tinker Toys. They're coming out with custom silicon, right?
Quintera, which is going to make chipsets for other people. But Mimosa has been working with the Quantenna guys to make the original chipset do what they want. They don't have to work so hard to take something meant for a laptop to work outdoors.
So the big advantage that I've seen with all this is their claim to fame is MuMimo, which is massively multiple in, multiple out, is their buzzword. And so their initial product offering, they're talking about having like 8x8 MIMO over the air at distance.
MIMO, more problems.
That's just... So that many antennas sounds complicated.
Well, maybe they don't have to do it with more antennas. They can do it with phasing, and there's other ways to accomplish it. I mean, you've got left-hand circular polarization, right-hand circular polarization, right. Vertical, horizontal. So that's 4x4. And then if they do...
Max on.
Yeah, but the tricks with that is, like, the circular ones have, like, specific characteristics which are better for certain environments, right?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the other polarizations will work better.
But if you're blasting away with everything you got, something's going
something's gonna stick. And damn any other bastard that happens to be anywhere near your frequency space. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
From the information that I've gotten, it will be faster than any unlicensed product that has been announced that I'm aware of. pretty cost effective compared to some of the other higher end unlicensed products.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing too.
And it will come connectorized or integrated. So
hopefully it's not vaporware.
Cautiously optimistic, right?
Yeah. I mean, if it truly manifests itself, it'll be some very neat hardware. And then looking at their petition to the FCC, as you know, as a huge proponent for amateur radio, I'm on the fence about their ban proposal for the 10 gig.
Their 10 gigahertz stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So as an amateur radio guy and the culture that I grew up in, you know, I say hell no. But as a business owner, I say that would be awesome. So I'm really on the fence about it because I come from both cultures.
It's like West Side Story.
Yeah.
You want a dance fight?
Funny guy.
Indeed. So yeah, the mimosa stuff. But you know what? And I've been hearing from a lot of big boys about it. A lot of big wisps, I know. So there's buzz. Yeah.
And actually, I'm not sure. I haven't heard much details as far as the actual product, but there are other companies coming out with product based upon that same Quantenna chipset. So it'll be interesting to see what they come out with.
No, I mean, if they just dump the chipset, what's gonna keep, say, a Ubiquiti or a Microtik from
going some? They outlined the advantages that they have, basically a head start.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, all those other companies that are using the same chipset, you know, they're not as far along in the process. You know, they weren't the ones working with Quantenna to get what they wanted. Not to say that they're not going to make something decent of it. I mean, you know, Atheros, you've got Cambium and Redwind and Microtik and Ubiquiti, and, you know, they're all making completely different platforms off of the same chip.
Right, but how long
sorry.
I was just going to say, how long does it take to buy one of their boards and then just disassemble the layers one by one and look at how it's put together?
Right, and I mean, if you look at all the Ubiquiti stuff, usually their first generation stuff is just a reference design with their, you know, with their particular paint on it, if you will. I mean, they put their paint job on it and put their software in it, and that's generally what a lot of their wireless stuff has been to date, you know, with the exception of AirFiber. You know, they rolled their own on that one.
I would hope that Mimosa put something together, some feature, something that they're licensing in that chipset, you know, so that way they get a taste no matter who uses the product, I guess.
Yeah. Do they have, what sort of OS is it? Is it very limited feature, high throughput, or is it more like super flexible, like, you know, let's say Ubiquiti on the command line or Microtik on the GUI or command line? Is it a layer 3 device, or is it more like Cambium?
Or is it controller based? Yeah, like centralized.
From what I have seen, it's less Microtik. You know, you're not doing BGP on this device.
Right.
But I mean, just due to the sheer amount of other technology available, it's going to be capable of doing more than than your standard Ubiquiti or LIGO Wave or whatever. You know, just due to having new technology.
And is the interface hideously complicated, or is it simple? As in, like a slider button, slow, fast.
Let's see here. What can I say about that? I've seen more complicated and I've seen less complicated.
So you're saying it's somewhere between Microtik and Ubiquiti?
That it's not nearly as bad as the original Microtik web interface.
Oh god, that thing was so hideous. The first time I ever used a Microtik router, you know, on the box. You pull it, you get the box, and you look at it, and it says, you know, go to 192.168.8.8.1. So I go there, and I'm like, why is everybody, you know, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over these Microtiks? It's just a DHCP server. If you guys, you remember that original web interface that they had?
Oh, it's hideous.
It was hideous.
I was using Microtik for 2 weeks before I realized they had a Winbox interface. I was amazed with it. I was actually fell in love with it. I was typing in and went, wow, the commands stick, because there was some amount of on the market that, you know, when you type in the command and it depended on your browser and it depended on this, and then you'd reboot it and it would lose its config. And this one was like, hold it. I was like, oh my God. And I was on a RAP board. It's a RAP 2C. That's what I installed it on. I actually just borrowed Oh, have I lost you? Or no?
No, you're still rocking.
Yeah, no, basically, yeah. So because I had this one, it was a custom version of Linux, and it was terrible. Then I started with Star OS, and I thought that was amazing because it had the OKs on boot up, which I thought was kind of neat. and then Makertik came, and I was like, oh my God, it's, and you can do dot dot, and it goes up a level, and I was like, yeah, this is the bee's knees. But yeah, no,
right. I can't, Tom, can I say I just can't wait to see you again?
He is definitely hilarious.
You're killing me, brother. It's been so long, and I need a good laugh. I needed this.
Pittsburgh mom.
It's gonna be, yeah. Pittsburgh is whatever. I don't know anything about Pittsburgh. Is anything in Pittsburgh? What's going on there?
The brothers.
I'll be there probably because I can drive there. I'll probably end up flying.
Kim's gonna come up with me, so.
Gotcha.
Well, are you gonna drive?
Probably.
You can stop by and pick me up.
Okay.
Which is savage. Sort I'm flying. Way,
I guess.
Yeah, I know. Hey, I actually, for a nonprofit, they were looking at. I can't remember. I think it was like 10, 15. Somewhere in the neighborhood routers, and so they wanted to do like this centralized management, blah blah blah, and all this other crap. I think it was content filtering. So they were going to do, from this reseller, they were going to do Sonic walls because they did centralized management. You had to load it on the server, did the content filtering. So I said, okay, what's your quote? Okay, $18,500 was the quote for that. And so I said, well, for your throughput. You could do 750s at each site and use OpenDNS.
That is an awesome content.
Yeah. So I was like, what do you need centralized management for? These routers, you put them in, you configure them once, you never have to touch them again, throw one on the shelf, we're good. And so I got them all in for under, I think it was like $500, right?
And then you charged them $10,000.
I didn't. It was a non-profit, and I was doing it through another place. So
I don't be nasty, sorry.
I did it just for the so and I honestly I have a soft spot for those nonprofits. They come to me, I can't say no. But
such a socialist. Oh my God.
No, it's karma. I'm expecting that the good karma to come back to me. It has nothing to do with socialism. This is all completely self serving.
It's good. No, I think it's good to be altruistic. No, I've only pulled your chain, sorry.
Well what eats me up on stuff like that is like, and I know I've completely diverged from the point, but what eats me up on stuff like that is, even if I charge them $5,000 for the equipment and the service, I would still be saving a ton of money, you know, and nonprofits, you know, every dime that they save, they put towards kids and stuff, right? But anyway, coming back around, like with a support contract, even if I could do it for $500, they still balked at first because there wasn't like this.
You've got to be cutting corners if you're doing it for
officials. You know, in one of the, and you know what, the reseller, they sent all the information I sent to him to that reseller that had quoted him. I was like, oh, guys, don't do that.
Don't do that.
And so they looked at the 750s, and one of the features of the 750 is a included plastic case. And they were like, oh, well, how good this can this be when they boast about having a plastic case? You know, so it's. Yeah. It's like, you know, and then they're like, yeah, there's no support, so it's something to kind of...
It's definitely a dog and pony show. Like, I run into this constantly where, you know, if you're not parading and, you know, just putting on this specific show, and Americans eat it up. I don't know why. I'm not one of the particular ones that it appeals to, but they just, if there's not some big marketing campaign that they heard on the radio on the way to work and seen in, you know, Google AdWords while they're at work and then watched on the television when they went home, then it's not a real, you know, a viable solution. Or a perfect example is Barracuda. You walk around airports, everywhere you go, Barracuda, Barracuda, Barracuda. So all of these business tops, they see that and they're inundated with that. And so when they want to talk about content filtering, this and that, the very first words that I hear are, are you going to use Barracuda? No, I'm not.
No, like, and like, it's, but even if you look at the ad for the 2011 on MakerTik, and they talk about, you know, it has 128 megs RAM. You know, what's its throughput? How many VPN tunnels can it have? What can it do? You know, rather than go, you know, boasting about, you know, 128 megs of RAM on a router. Like, I mean, when was the last time someone picked up a TP-Link and went, I wonder how much RAM it has? Now, don't worry about one of the feature requests I'm going to have, which will obviously be denied because of this broadcast, will be, basically I was saying, 750s with 2 gigs of RAM. And I know you're thinking, Tom, what the... But I was thinking for, like, having loads of routes for blackholing and stuff like that, so you could just push out a policy with BGP. And it'd be nice, you know, even though it'd probably take the smaller processors a week to get through that route and longest prefix match. But, like, I don't know. It's a great product, and it could be so much better, you know.
All right, so I'm saying that's what frustrates me. MakerTik needs to officially launch, like, a small community-driven board, so it'll be, and this is just off the top of my head, random people. It would be Tom Smith, it could be Mike Hammett, Justin Miller, JJ Boy, Justin Wilson, and Craig Soule. We would gladly be an advisory board to say MakerTik, where they could bounce ideas. So, hey, we're thinking about doing this, guys. What do you think? We could say, no, don't do that. Do this over here.
200K plus car.
Right.
Just like the new cloud features in the new version. It's like, okay, well, the dynamic DNS, that's pretty cool, but it's not configurable at all. So what if I'm using multiple LANs and one of them is down, and it's like, okay, well, now I don't know what IP address it's on. There's no configurability. So I guess maybe it'll come in the future.
Yeah, no, in fairness, I think they're dipping their toes. It was a good idea. I didn't even come up with it myself. So it was a good idea, but I just, like, Capsman, you know, the concept of it I get, but when you actually look at the fucking interface, it's going
and then look at Unify.
Pardon?
I said look at Capsman interface, look at Unify. They're kind of the same thing.
I mean, that's their competition. They're not competing with the Cisco controller. They're not competing with Ruckus controller. They're competing directly with Unify. That's their only competition. So.
And even if it works better, it looks like junk.
It's just like, I mean, I think we'll need a 4-week course for that one. I don't think we'll learn.
I think from things I've seen on the forum, what we will see is them get Capsman working in a usable fashion, and then we're going to see a dude update or something similar. Or maybe it's just wishful thinking.
We're done. You're high in the sky now. The elephant's flying. It's...
You don't think so? I think they'll add Caps Manager support into a program. Whether it's the dude or not, I hope it is. But maybe that's just me hoping and dreaming.
Well, I guess if it was in the dude, you could do that that dude package thing and run it on a router at the local site, right?
Yeah.
Do your Caps Man from there.
I think on the Eurofighter, like, one of the big things they were saying about the design of the Eurofighter, which is apparently meant to be like 20 years into the future, but it's 20 years behind schedule, so it's now in the past, it's obsolete.
Is that some airplane that you guys are making that's supposed to...
Yeah, but it's like 20 years behind schedule, so when it comes off the platform, it'll be already obsolete. So, but they had actually a deadly cockpit design, and they were actually spent loads of money on thinking, I'm a pilot, I'm trying to shoot at a plane, preferably not a passenger jet like some dickheads in Ukraine. Fucking assholes.
That's great. You know what I first saw? I was like, oh my god, they found the Malaysian flight? It got shot in the Ukraine? And I was no, it's another one.
It's missing four, I think. But no, it's terrible. Like, I mean, stupid assholes supplying arms to another bunch of stupid assholes.
I'm going to say that the Dude is by far my favorite monitoring piece of software that I've used.
I like Observium, but I can't get the thing to work right.
Now, as far as charting goes, the Dude has crappy charts. But everything else, I just like the weather map. It's such, I just love...
Yeah. For like a What's Up Gold replacement, the Dude is like awesome.
Windows 7, like, I think it's pretty nice, but actually one of the annoying things is you actually have to right-click more to actually open up applications than you do. Like, XP was actually pretty smooth. Windows 7 had nice visual features and switch modes. The problem is that if I want to open up another instance of Word, I have to right-click, I have to select. Oh, then I might have to run it as administrator and have to do. But, like, you know, in fairness to Steve Jobs, a lot of things that disagree with him, like, you know, the bubble that he wanted all Mac users to live in. Quick question about the Ubiquiti ones. What chipset are they using on the Ubiquiti switches? Are they Marvel, Broadcom, or are they using Athros as well?
I haven't cracked one open.
Okay. I'm going to link in with Robert on LinkedIn and say, connect with me. And he's going to go, you Tom. He's going to go, who is this Tom dickhead? Anyway.
No, he has people to say that. He wouldn't even say it himself. He'll just have his people. Oh, you're a dickhead.
He lets other people read his LinkedIn profile. Is he not paranoid? I'd be worried. I'd be worried that they lape me. You know. Flape me? Rape me, is it? Yeah. You know, like Facebook rape. Okay, I'm moving this again. LinkedIn rape. So lie rape. Okay, anyway, moving on.
It's complicated.
Can you edit that joke, please?
That would work. No.
No, I'm going to stretch it out so that it's even more painful.
Yeah, it's kind of like...
We're in a loop.
Just give me a second. Yeah. No, I'm going to get it now. This is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, no. But,
Yeah, I was... So, we moved into a new house, and I've been cleaning it out, and I found this in a box a minute ago. It's a 2010 quarter three guide.
Nice.
It's got some sweet hardware in there. I think they're...
Has any
is that the RV 1100 announcement?
Yeah, it actually is. The RV 1100 in there.
Yeah.
Jesus, JJ, what's wrong with you?
What?
How do you remember that?
I don't know.
411s. A bunch of 411s. I'm real proud of those. RV
800 got it. 411s were a very solid board.
750s. 750G. Yeah, so this is really old. That was when the 250GS came out, right? And they were giving those away free.
I found one today that was new in box, and I used it.
We bought a rig of them, and then we didn't sell any for years. Then I started giving them away, like, as prizes, like, in class. And then people started trying to buy them off us. We were like... So I actually... So I kind of created an artificial demand by flooding them. You know, people actually went, well, yeah, they're handy. The interface was easier to make, you know. Anyway. Sorry, guys.
Circle right back around.
Yeah, it's full circle.
Yeah, no. This is more of a support group counseling session. You should all be on comfortable couches with notepads and pens and then go, Tom, Xanax. To be fair... Like, I was given out, remember, of one of just the chats I was given out about the IPsec features, and I asked for help, I said urgently, and Fairness Mikrotik came in to the rescue, and it was operator error. So there are times that I'm wrong, and I'd like to admit it, and I'm willing to learn. I just wish some of the interface designers were also willing to learn.
You know what I've started again. Switching around to on my... But my IPsec, so I've never had a really solid MikroTik to Cisco ASA IPsec. Have you guys done that? For some reason...
I tried it on Juniper, and I wish that I had that week and a half of my life back.
I've done it plenty of times and in many situations, but it never seems to be like 100% solid. So if you're going like to a Cisco device, it just always works with an IPsec tunnel. But I don't know, for some reason I just can't get it to be solid. And even MikroTik to MikroTik, especially when you start getting more IPsec endpoints on there, I've seen it get a little squirrely. But lately, I've been having really good success doing GRE tunnels and doing IPsec over the top.
Yeah, really? I'm using GRE tunnels to help people get around some problems with arbitrary censorship for VoIP, believe it or not. So you can't make a VoIP call because you'll get black holes. And the GRE tunnels are pretty, it's in a country that's not exactly the most
friendly.
It's going through a country that's not, basically it's a country that's friendly, going through a country that doesn't quite value free speech and friendliness and all that. Anyway, so basically, yeah, the GRE tunnels are pretty awesome, pretty reliable. They work well in 6.15. There was a bug on 6.7. I had kernel panics, which was kind of a bit annoying.
Mm.
But like, basically, in fairness now, we were pushing 700 megs through the tunnel, so it was kind of... It was a bit bigger than your standard GRE tunnels, to give it its due. But no, 6.15 rock solid, I have to say. IPsec, we're doing it between 1100 and a Fortinet appliance. So what we normally try to do is use MakerTik, but we kind of got a managed contract and they said you have to do it into our Fortinet appliance. And I said, for that amount of money a month, I'll do it to anything. But we matched up all the settings perfectly, like all the key life stuff. Now, I'm sure you did that too, man.
No, for me, I'll have it solid for a week, 2 weeks, and then it'll just decide to dump. Arbitrarily, it'll just dump. And you can clear out the SAs, and immediately it comes right. I got it.
Would you call me?
SA? Yeah, so it's... it's weird. And there's no explaining it. But so I started... Because we used to do a lot of our management interfaces would just IPsec back to our ASA, and that's how we get to everything. But I've since started doing, because ASAs won't do a GRE tunnel because they're not routers. Anytime you hit a limitation on an ASA, it's not a limitation, it's that it's a firewall, it's not a router. So we do GRE over to a MikroTik and just IPsec, and works great. It's been really solid for us.
What I find is if there's interruptions to, let's say, the link between the two routers, the IPsec can be pretty unforgiving. Even with a Cisco client, we found that. But then if you actually do it inside some sort of tunnel like IPIP or I prefer GRE because of the keep-alives. You know that the interface is up or down. But I have been honest, I kind of do more and more of IPsec now with MakerTik, so I'm kind of probably going to run into your pain. But being honest, I've had issues, like Cisco a few years ago had a lot of trouble with IPsec, tunnels holding up, like on long range links and stuff like that, where you might have 500 or 600 milliseconds latency, possibly not the best copper in the world between the two points.
Right.
I haven't... But I will probably run into that.
Well, I found that I like GRE so much better because I like actually routing across those links. So it's an encrypted link, but you can still route across them. And so instead of, IPsec, where you just put in some policy and say this traffic and go into that traffic and it'll just kind of all of a sudden disappear off your router and encrypt and do all this stuff. It's just a little bit more logical flow. When you're doing like a trace route, you'll see it actually hit the tunnel interfaces. And I think not just for me. So like when I put it in place, whenever my techs are troubleshooting and stuff, it's a lot easier for them to kind of grab a hold of and wrap their mind around.
So speaking about routing and trace routes and stuff, do you guys know of a product that will scrape your router's interfaces and match up the IPs and create PTR records for those IPs based on the interface names? So you trace routes, you can post your own DNS and trace route and get the IP PTRs for the IPs. based off the interface names. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I know what you're trying to say. So you're wanting to automate the creation of those PTRs without looking up each router and figuring out what each one is.
Right.
Yeah. I keep two answers. That is a stupid idea, Justin. It's not possible. And then, that's a great idea. I think it's a good product to make.
So, I have one program that will do it. It's open source. It's called NetDot.
Uh-huh.
The problem is, it doesn't work well with Microtech. I mean, it works. But so you add the router, the first router. It gets the hardware type and everything correct for asset tracking. And then you add the next one. So the first one's 1100. You add a 750. It changes the previous one to a 750. The next one you add, it might be a 450. It'll change the previous two to 450s.
Gotcha.
You add the next one. It changes all of them back to whatever the next one is. It just...
The architectures. Yeah.
You know what I see, like, in my head, the way I you know, because I, like, try and figure out how I would do it. I would do... Because SNMP, you can pull interface IPs, right?
You can.
So couldn't you just... IP address and then SNMP string, and then it would just crawl through and then create all the pointer records for you?
The only tricky thing about my critique with the SNMP is it seems to, for different interface types, have, like, not even interface types, but if you have different chipsets.
So you're saying just walk all those OIDs and then parse that data and then have another script that creates the PTRs?
Yeah. Why not?
The only problem, have you noticed that when you have different wireless interfaces, like as in a 711 versus a 411 with the wireless card, that they have actually different OIDs for the properties, even though, like, your WLAN 1. So your WLAN 1 on one router will have this OID, but, you know, it's...
You're missing the point. I don't think you actually need to walk those. You just need to walk the IP address table, because it's...
All right.
Ethernet and IP address right
so
there.
So, as far as the PTR name goes, you want that to be? Would you want it to be? Would you want to pull the name of the interface and have that in there?
You'd probably want, like, router host name dash.
You would just. It would, like, either be the comment.
Name, I guess
it would either be the comment that you put it there, or the interface name, because you can name the interfaces exactly what you want that PTR to be.
Well, I mean, because I know it like, SNMP will match up, I think somewhere in the OID string, it matches up interface name with IP address. Because I know, like, in my cacti, when I pull them, it pulls, you know, so it shows all the interfaces and the IPs associated with them. So there is a matchup somewhere in there. So
yeah, I love doing the walk with the dude because it's so clean.
Like, yeah, so you could just SNMP, what's the host name, SNMP, what's the interface name, and then you would have an IP associated with that, and then you would just generate all the pointer records.
You could also use the Microtech API to do it.
Yeah.
I never played with that.
I was going to say the SNMP would probably be more solid in the long term, though. Because the API, I think, occasionally changes, doesn't it?
Hmm. But that is a good idea, because that's something recently, you know, when I got on my NetBlocks from Aaron, you know, I was creating PTRs for those. And, you know, I got through, like, the first 50, and I was like, this is a bunch of bull crap. I'm not doing all these manually. And then I found out that you can just, you know, put that, you know, do those strings and bind where you do, like, $, whatever.
You know what I was looking up the other day is the Microtech dynamic IP thing. They've actually got it in there so that you specify, like, a DNS server, right? And something like that.
DNS, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that almost sounds like enough. If it would just automatically, you could point it towards your DNS servers and have it update the pointer records instead of the forward records. I guess that would never mind.
And you could adjust the source address so that you know you'd kind of, you know, the way you your router.
That's only going to handle one interface or one IP, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can't really rig it to do everything you want,
I guess. You have to scrape it and grab that information and create those records.
Sorry, Justin, you were saying about Observium, which I'm actually a fan of, because it's the first graphing product based on PHP that I could set up in under 4 hours and have it working. and the Bort SMP version 3, which I thought was actually pretty impressive. When I say 4 hours, I mean Metal Tin, Linux, following the guide, and actually using and doing SMP version 3, which I think Cacti does an okay job, but I still couldn't get it working, sorry. I was using Greg's blog, which was very helpful, on Cacti, but I still obviously was missing the je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, it's kind of hairy at first. It's a learning curve.
Cacti kicked my ass for like 2 years, and then I said, well, if Greg can do it, JJ can do it.
Aww, that's my sister's retarded. She's a pilot.
Well, Justin, what were the issues you were seeing? Or
so the graphs have very odd spikes. It's, you know, first of all, the bandwidth should have been 250 meg range, and it was only about 100. And then
that sounds like a
no audio.
Yeah, the audio. Lost your audio, but that almost sounds
Justin,
like a.
We've lost your audio. We've lost your audio, Justin.
There you go. See, just popped off. So that almost sounded like a 64-bit counter problem, which I've run into before as well.
Yeah, I've seen that too, where he probably selected 64-bit counter where he probably didn't need to.
I'm back.
Hello? Yeah, you're back. Hello.
I hear you, Tom.
We'll blame the host. So, what did you not hear?
Pretty much everything.
Okay, so
whatever you were saying when you were doing this.
Yeah, the graph has big holes missing in it, so it'll have like one bar, and then it'll skip, and then have another bar, and then it'll have a hill here, and then it'll just die, and then it'll have another graph that goes up. And one of the guys on one of the lists said that was a disk I/O problem. So I'm running it in ESXi on a shared host with a bunch of other stuff, and I'm having a problem. So it's 15K SAS drives and quad core with RAM and, you know, whatever. It's
15K SAS drives. Yeah, no, you're doing a good bit better than me. I cheaped out and got the 10K, you know, SATA drives from Velociraptor or Western Digital. But yeah, no, we have a certain amount of those troughs, and I actually put it down to maybe network issues, so I just kind of ignored it.
Just monitoring like the next hop. Actually, I have Microtech or RouterOS running in an ESXi host on the same box, and I was monitoring that, and that was having problems. So I know there's no
network. So it's a
my Cacti works awesome.
Yeah, so does mine.
Yeah, but does it look as nice as Observium? Do you see
it's
the graphs?
It's all a tool. So yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
With the mouse over? Nice mouse over?
Does Observium do real time?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's cool.
That works fine. It's just the graphs are stored.
No, and it actually supports SMP version 3 read well. Sorry for cutting across.
Yeah, I thought it might have been 64-bit counters for the SMP strings not getting set, but it's all set automatically, so it's there.
Yeah.
That would cause wrapping, whatever. But
yeah, I was going to say on some of my stuff on my gig links, I wasn't using 64-bit counters initially, and so when I fixed that, like all of my bandwidth profiles, like whoop, came in and fixed that they're supposed to.
Our bandwidth provider uses a custom solution called EM7. I don't know if any of you guys have ever heard of it, but they use funny math, and so I busted them on it because, you know, I'm graphing all my interfaces from several different applications, and their graphs were about 30 to 40% higher than mine on 95th percentile consumption, and so we had to get in there and argue who was wrong. So
who won?
I did.
Goodbye.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, it was definitely a win because they adjusted their math. It was way in their favor. So ever since this company acquired the new company, they used to be on UberSmith, which I don't know if you guys have ever seen or used that, but UberSmith is like a data center management kind of thing. You can manage racks, co-location space. It's basically full CRM and ticketing for data centers.
And the old guys use that, and then these new guys use this custom EM7, and their math was way off. So I didn't get a credit for all the overcharges, but I guess that's okay.
Have you ever noticed a difference between Dude monitoring a link, you know, in the weather map, between SNMP monitoring and RootOS monitoring? Because I've noticed that often the SNMP monitoring looks like 20 to 30%. Now I'm using SNMP version 3. It looks 20 to 30, maybe 50% higher with SNMP than with. And my theory is maybe that RootOS samples the instantaneous, you know, throughput at the time, as opposed to
instead of the average
counters.
Oh yeah, I've seen that, and but I've not seen anything that would be outside of just statistical sampling noise. You know, just
my dude instance. All the labels go dead all the time now.
Is it version 4?
3.6.
Okay, I had that happen on version 4, and I went back to 3.6 because it was just almost useless.
Are you using Dude on a router, or are you actually putting it on a Windows server, like a VM or something?
It's on a Windows 2008 machine that's no VM virtualization or anything. A lot of the devices, so if you go to click on devices and you click on RouterOS tab, it has a list of all the devices. All the RouterOS ones, they fail. All of them are just failing. All the passwords are correct and everything. It just doesn't work anymore. Oh. It's reached critical mass, and it's just...
I think there is a limit in the amount of data. Someone was saying they're using SQLite or something like that, so there's some sort of 2 gig.
That's in 4, I think. The SQLite database is in 4.
And I think there's a 2 gig limit on that, so maybe that might be... But I haven't run into that issue. In fairness, Dude has been relatively reliable.
The one failing thing about Dude is that it doesn't do automated backups for you.
Yeah.
I think if you add a MikroTik device, it should start backing that pool up.
I would have to agree with that. But since they don't, I know somebody that made a pretty clever program that keeps it on their blog that does that for you.
Rancid? Which I found,
huh?
Rancid?
No, Greg's little...
Oh, my ghetto one?
Yeah, your ghetto.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was in a pinch.
Didn't you, make a script that would comb through Dude and put it into Rancid and a few other systems?
Yeah.
And we can just go to your blog and download that script, right?
No.
I might throw something together, because what you need to do is shut down the Dude service for a moment.
I have to restart it often. But I do have a script
Do a file backup.
I have a script that logs into the web interface of the Dude and backs up the file, the backup automatically. It does it nightly. It just stored in Subversion every night.
Nice.
That's cool.
It's over SSL too.
Yeah, I did Rancid for the first time about a year ago, I think. Stuck it on my Cacti server, just to back up a bunch of Cisco devices. It worked pretty well.
Works on MikroTik, and I also have a custom script that I wrote to back up AirFiber and Ubiquiti devices.
Very cool. Well, I think that's about it. I gotta be at work in the morning.
Yeah, I do too. I need to go to sleep.
This has only been 3.5 hours.
Let's see, we started at, a little bit before 9, 10, 11. Yeah, it's been, close to 3 hours. Yeah, well, it was, 8:40, 9. So we'll go right to left since Tom's on the phone over there. So JJ, you got anything interesting coming up?
Just working on that fiber project and the MUM, and I'll just be happy to see all you guys since I missed it last year. It'll definitely be nice to get up there and get to see you guys face to face again. And that's about all I got going on.
All right, Miller, what you got?
I'm going on vacation in August.
Oh yeah, where to?
Seattle.
Hey, I got to go there.
So, looking forward to that, and MUM, and Wade just hired a new guy. He's doing pretty good. He took home a 951 and told me it was complete garbage because he couldn't get it to work. I'm like, you're using Quickset and you have no guidance at all. So
yeah,
training for you to call it complete garbage. But
yeah, I've actually started training a new guy. I'm gonna get my own guy now finally. I started training him, and he's been taking a MicroTik home, and bless him, he's trying so hard. And then works at it for 3 days, and then say, "Hey, take a look at this." Click, 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 click. Okay, now it's done. You go, poor guy. All right, Mike, what do you got going, brother?
Well, should be taking delivery, hopefully less than a month, of an SIAE license link. For a customer of mine. Awesome. It's not even here yet, and they want 3 more. So then they'll give me money to go do all the stuff that I want to do on my own network.
Very nice.
Very nice.
Congratulations.
All right, Tom, what do you got going?
Well, I got some guys on site doing 3 sector upgrades there at the moment, and they're putting in 3 MIMO sectors. But no, other than that, no, pretty busy, but doing a lot of research, doing a lot more with BGP lately. And
I just turned up BGP on our last link, so
that was it. I joined the BGP club since the last cast as well, so got my own ASN and feeling all fancy the pants now.
I have one of those x86 routers, and I'm going there to upgrade it. I reboot it before doing the upgrade. Dead.
Oh no.
Dead.
So this was
the phone with Windstream at the time, and said, "Hey, my router just died. I'm going to go over to the office and pick up a different router." I went to the office, picked up a router, came back, had it configured and operational before they were ready with their BGP config.
Oh, cool.
So it was pretty eventful.
Nice. No, I like to be honest, and I love the X86 when it's running on the BGP, and I'm kind of still envious of Greg's dual 100 gig feeds, you know, that you have in the...
Oh, yeah, 100 gig feeds. Yeah, no, we're not nearly so big.
Look, Greg... Tom.
Well, it still gets it done. You just had a kid, Tom, so I know it's working.
Yeah, no, it's really cold. it's pretty cool. Well, I'm learning a lot, but I'm quite busy. Economy's improving. Obama's doing good work over there, I believe.
Oh, that's good, that's good. I know over here we've got, what am I doing? We've taken over management of an airport, so I've been doing a lot of crazy stuff with MicroTik to make it work, because it's an old university network, and so we can only do certain things. We're allowed to do this and that, but they haven't let us put our own gear on the network yet, so we have to ride some of their infrastructure. So I have a ton of tunnels, a ton of encrypting, all this weird stuff. It's all cobbled together, but it's running 100% rock solid, and it met the deadline, and it's going, and it's all on old PCs and 750s, and I think we spent about $150 total.
Wow.
And it's got it working. So it's brilliant. It's brilliant stuff. And then what else do we have going? I'm looking forward to a vacation of some sort in the near future. I am like so burned out. I need to go away and turn off my phone. Hopefully Pittsburgh is too far away for me to even look at that as like something upcoming, and it's like still too much.
What about Pittsburgh and then go shooting for a day or two afterwards?
Sorry. Well, how long are you going to be in town?
I don't know yet. Like, I haven't booked the tickets yet. I'm kind of trying to shoehorn in some clients over there, and we'll see how that goes. I suppose I haven't really decided. Would you stay on for a bit longer? If
I would stay, I would definitely stay longer if you're gonna stay longer.
Cool. Mike's kind of going, no, not staying longer with that hat. JJ Boyd is kind of going, I don't know, could I last longer than 2 days with Tom? Justin,
I'm there.
I'm really looking forward to seeing you. 2 years is just too long, you know?
For sure. You can't quit me. That's all I know.
No.
I'm like herpes. Just when you think I'm gone, bam. Right back in there. Just show up unexpected.
Guys, it is 10 to 6 in the morning and I haven't had much sleep.
Okay.
Oh, God. That's how much I love you guys.
Yeah, it's almost midnight for me, so I'm getting a little sleepy, Tom. I'm gonna go to
1 a.m. here. For JJ and I.
Yeah. We're EST.
Alright, so I'm gonna kill the recording. Thanks everybody for watching and listening to us rant. And hopefully we'll do some more of these before. Maybe we'll do another one before the thing with the stuff, the mum.
Just cut this one in half and, you know. Just
release it twice.
Piecemeal it. There you go.
Part one, part two.
Well, all right. Bye, everybody.